my 73 listeners. Can you believe I got 73 now? It's hard to believe I've got 73 listeners. Huh. That's a handful, isn't it? That's a crock. I love it. Anyhow, welcome to the year 2006. That's 2006, Dr. Fred Bell's Health Science and Energy Show. Our guest on New Year's Eve, of course, was the famous Sean Morton. And I'll tell you what, that movie we talked about is a go-getter gas, that Joe Killian there. I was on the set a lot of the days out there when we were making that, and it was a lot of fun. We had 18 beautiful women on that, and because, you know, Joe Killian was all about having the girls come and winning a weekend with him in this famous castle. And some scenes were hilarious, throwing girls out of limousines and shooting them and watching them do the double takes and the triple takes and watching the girls themselves, because they were all new young actresses and they're all fighting amongst themselves who gets what. And it was a real comedy. And even the making of it, of course. And I hope to see that all over the place. I know it's playing in Europe now. He's also very good at his remote viewing. You should go to his website, which is DelphiAssociates.org, I believe. You can just type his name, Sean, S-E-A-N, Morton, M-O-R-T-O-N, into the search engine, and you'll get information there. Now, what's happened here is I've been going through these older health energy science tapes from the 80s that I did, and I discovered that on the back side of them, some of them, the way they recorded them over there, some of them were recorded on both sides, the same show, and others recorded two different shows, one on each side. And I just suddenly realized the other night when we were doing the one on Sannyasi and the How to Become a Contactee that there was a missing piece. So this is a missing piece for about December 22nd show. That would be two shows back, I believe. Maybe it'll be the last. No, it'll be last Tuesday's show, actually. And there was a piece missing on one of those, so we're going to play that missing half an hour. And then we're going to go into two more other shows. So it's actually going to be a three-show deal today, which will be a little bit more than an hour. Any questions? There are also pictures we posted up on the website of the holographic projector, and my daughters came over from England. And when they were here, we had a lot of fun. And I realized that all three of my daughters took their first breath of life inside of a pyramid in my bedroom. I delivered the last two myself. And the other one was delivered by a midwife. I did have a midwife on standby, but when Megan came, I was delivering her as the midwife was arriving at the house. It pretty much became a delivering specialist, a real doctor kind of deal, you know. And Megan is the one, of course, she's an Aries. I think her birthday is the 8th of April. No, I'm sorry, the 4th of April. And she does sort of dematerialize into those systems. She's very into this stuff. My kids grew up in the temple. So not only did they take their first breath of life in this world inside of a pyramid with lasers shooting all over the place, but they grew up that way along with my parrots. Sometimes it's hard to tell the difference between the two, except the parrots have feathers. So anyway, we have a lot of fun when they come, because we fire up the lasers, and because it's a vortex, they're resonating on it. They were born in it. They were raised in it. Even though they live in England now, half their lives they lived here. And so as a result, they have a great time in the vortex. And those of you that are planning families out there, get out of, you know, we were a vegetarian, fairly drug-free family even then, alcohol sort of free, bringing these kids into the world. The mothers did nothing. The only dirty person in the whole deal was me, you know, drinking a little bit here and there, which I don't do now, but did in those days. And the mothers were very, very clean in their lifestyles. No smoking, no bad foods, vegetarian pretty much. And Rowena, the mother of the last two daughters, only had one contraction when she delivered Megan, and no birth pains at all. When she delivered the middle daughter, Mary, she had, I think, 8 contractions, and then immediately the baby was born. Both girls came in within, from the first contraction. Of course, Megan was only one, but from the 8 contractions, within 45 seconds to 90 seconds, they were born from the first labor pain. So that's how quick it is. There isn't this thing about having to have pain of birth is a thing that people put together out of ignorance. It's not necessary. There should be no pain in birth. I know some friends of mine even gave birth to children underwater in swimming pools and jacuzzis and things at the right temperature and no pain. So, and then, of course, we put them on a nutritional. We used our vitamins and our mineral formulas exclusively on the through the all the term of the pregnancy. And we did go out and practice some of the Lamas and some of the other things that are necessary. We did learn all that stuff, but we never needed to use it. There was no need to take a breath and hold it and relax and push, none of that stuff. It just they just came when they were supposed to. And both mothers, within minutes of delivering birth, were up running around and taking care of the kids. I mean, within minutes, not hours, days, laying in bed forever, within minutes, both mothers. So it's all possible. So if you're planning a family out there, I highly recommend that you go into one of our Portamid systems and the lasers through the entire pregnancy, and maybe even as Burt Reynolds used to do, you might even get them pregnant in the pyramid, as he used to say. He was a pyramid user. He used, and if you look at the movie Longest Yard that he did, he used one of my vitamins in that, under the bed. But we prefer them over the bed. So anyway, the Portamid systems are great. And now we're going to start listening in. Dr. Bell, this is already engaged. It's the second side of a tape from an earlier show. And it's the show about Sannyasi and the Pleiades and becoming a contactee. And I do think that he didn't even wait for us. I think he's already talking in there. I think Dr. Bell is such a nervous cat, but we'll find out really quick. You know, there he is. See,
they kept suggesting that there be
see?
More
talking about
something.
Didn't wait for us. That's the kind of guy he is.
Be brought in, and so, and you got to realize that Sannyasi, even though she's a gentle-looking female, intellectually blows me away in about 2 microseconds. I mean, her level of intellect. It's so far beyond mine, I feel like a blithering idiot sometimes, even asking her some of the questions. And she, once in a while, she gets quite stern and quite harsh. And she got harsh with Billy one time, and her comment was that centered it, you know, when he asked her, why can't more people be involved? And he said that those few people, and why don't people accept it? Why don't more people accept this, you know, what's going on? She says that those few people who prefer to turn their minds off rather than give it the minimal exercise of thought will block you. And she warned him that some would accept the experience as an absolute. A few would come before they made a decision. Others would never believe even if a ship landed on their porch. And you can actually see that in our society existing, of course, on all levels, because we are what I would call a primal society. And I remember one of my other lecturing friends on the UFO circuit back when I was doing that, when people would say, is there intelligent life out there? And he would comment, I don't know about that, but there's no intelligent life here. Because when you think about the wars and the situations that we get into all the time over here, you can see that we have, and this terrorism and all that, it's so barbaric. And other people were considered too negative and labeled out as having an auric stench. And an auric stench is, as they call it, is a distasteful phrase which describes the negative energies which emanate from Earth humans, often without their knowledge or conscious thought. And these frequencies create a state of altered equilibrium in the Pleiadian being. For this reason, are monitored carefully. And then, during the time of the contact, at one point, there was a situation taking place whereby a Swiss Mirage fighter approached the Pleiadian ship. And in Volume 1, there were photographs of it. You saw Volume 1, didn't you?
I've seen both of the books.
Yeah. Those of you that are interested out there, by the way, I do have a couple of Volume 2s left. There's only 1,000 to 2,000 of these books ever printed. They have pictures in them. Volume 2 has pictures that are 12 inches by 12 inches, four color. They're poster pictures of ships taken at very close distances. And not only that, it has pictures of from the inside of the ship looking out on formations of ships in flight. And these pictures, you know, they have done every kind of, and I speak of they, I'm talking about private agencies, governmental agencies, they have done everything to prove that they're phonies, and they're not. As a matter of fact, when you really study the photographs and see how they relate to the trees, and realize the guy that took these pictures, number one, Billy Ottmeyer, only has one arm, and almost every one of his contacts that he had to ride out into this Swiss countryside in a moped, so there was, the ships are huge in size, so it doesn't take long to realize that they're real pictures. Plus, people have gone on the sites many, many, many times. You know, witnesses have, have then photographed the same areas that the ships were in to make photo comparisons. In other words, if there's a set of four or five trees in the background with a mountain, other people that were checking out the authenticity of the pictures would take pictures in that same place. And then at one time, they even tried to wire in models. There was a group that went over there and tried to make models and put them together to prove that they were fakes, and they failed miserably. So it was quite interesting. There's one picture in Volume 2, I think even Alan Hynek's seen it, of a flying saucer coming off the astral plane right next to a 747. It's in Volume 2 of the Pleiades, but it was taken at an airport back in Texas. And it was not a Pleiadian ship, because the Pleiadian ships don't pull those kinds of stunts. They don't come out of a warp speed into the Earth's atmosphere, because this creates a tremendous stress on the planet. But some civilizations will do that. And because one of the negative things when they do that is it not only does disrupt the atmosphere of the planet, it also causes these astral vampire things to happen that we were talking about. These vampire-type creatures are seen usually after a UFO sighting, not that they're a product of the UFO scene, but that they move through time continuums like UFOs do. It's much like if a ship is sailing in the water, you know, say a heavy cruiser, a submarine. You know, a ship may sail, let's say, down the Pacific Ocean. Then 2 weeks later, a reconnaissance helicopter or a dirigible flies over with infrared or heat-seeking equipment. They can actually measure where the ship was, even though it was there 2 weeks before, because of the sensitivity of the equipment used, using infrared. The same thing happens when one of these saucers moves over from one dimension to the other. When this happens too close to the atmosphere, too close within a planetary environment, it will cause these creatures, which live on the astral realms, to move across. Now, the more higher races, for example, like the Pleiadians and the other people that I've spoken about, that are what I would consider a more higher evolved extraterrestrial race of people, won't cause their spacecraft to behave like that within the atmosphere of an Earth. They might be invisible, but they're not moving from one dimension to another, because they know that they'll create that kind of energy. You know, so what they do is they make their dimensional changes outside of an astral field, or what's called a ring path out of a planet. They'll do it out in space and then come down. But these other what happens is when these creatures are released, now the time that they are normally released and they're most dangerous is after the full moon, for the first 2 weeks after the full moon. That's when they come over. And because they are lust type creatures, they seek out the sexual organs of animals. And they'll seek out humans, but humans, they somehow or other are not able to penetrate the human field. So what happens is the humans might act crazy, but they don't get their insides removed like the sheep do, because they go in through the sexual parts of an animal, like a sheep or a cow, and then they materialize inside the animal and drain out all of the flesh and the blood and all of these things, and then they go out again, and the animal just falls apart. I mean, there's nothing there but skin and bones. You know, they've seen them. There's been like 200 or 300 of them done that way at a time, and there's been a lot of it in different newspapers up in those areas.
Let me tell you that I have talked to Dr. J. Allen Hynek about cattle mutations and the correlation that seems to exist between the appearance of UFOs and the cattle mutilations, and he verifies that in fact cattle mutilations do in fact exist. They are happening. There seems to be a strong correlation between the sighting of UFOs and these cattle mutilations. The removal of the organs is almost surgical in nature. Mutilation is not the proper word. It is almost a surgical precision cut.
Look at what happens down the Bermuda Triangle. It's the same energy in the Bermuda Triangle, except instead of them coming over here, we end up going on the other side, because that's a vortex that was created back when Atlantis was destroyed, and the capital city of Atlantis was Poseidon, was right off the coast of Florida where the Bermuda Triangle is. So it left a current there. Even in the human body, we have those kinds of currents. Those are the things that allow the God consciousness to come to our physical manifestation. And those are the kinds of things that we have a tendency to abuse, and we have to just keep that part of our bodies upright. And that's what meditation does, and being spiritual.
Anyhow, that's another subject on another day. One of the interesting things is in the Pleiadian case is that when they landed over in Switzerland, they left these landing tracks. You've heard of the UFO landing tracks before?
Well, I'm familiar with some of the depressions that occur when UFOs are sighted in areas.
Yeah, well, what happens in the I've got pictures of them in some of my books here, but What happens is on the Pleiadian ships, they leave about three, they have like a tripod that comes down on the bottom of them, and they leave three different impressions on the ground. And a couple of things that are quite interesting happen. And this has been photographed, there's pictures all over the world on this particular case. These are about 10 feet apart, and they're about, I'd say about 4 feet large, the impressions that are left. But once the ship leaves, because of the anti-gravity drive and propulsion system on it, it causes the grass to grow in a swirled pattern. Like, in other words, it doesn't grow straight back. It grows back in a, you know, in a clockwise cyclic pattern. It's like if you're looking out at the Milky Way, the same kind of cyclic thing that you would see there is the way the grass grows. And this will happen for up to 3 years. So it's quite profound, the what the grass looks like after one of these ships takes off. And it eventually does recover, but it takes a long, long, long time. And you can go out in a field, for example, because in Switzerland where they were landing, and you could see these big three impressions where they landed. It's like one time three ships came down, so there's nine of them. And the grass is up finally about, I'd say 2.5 feet tall, and yet the part where they were landing is still growing in a swirled manner. The other thing that happens is when one of them lands is the bugs will come in, insects like the energy field of a spaceship. So usually you'll find like hundreds of beetles crawling around in the area where the ship had landed, which is quite interesting. If you take the soil, if you'd actually dig up the soil from a landing track from the Pleiadian ships or some of the other ones and put it in water, it will float on the top of the surface of the water because it's dried out. It's kind of like, it's hard to describe exactly what it's like, but it's like almost petrified. And if you take some soil, like right next to it where the pad didn't touch the ground, it'll just sink to the bottom or mix with the water, depending on whether it's a high clay or a high sand soil. But it, regardless of what it is, when the UFO lands on it, it will float. And then there's another, and then if they land in the ice, some of them that land in the ice, they've had landings of different areas where the snow is, it burns a like a razor fine hole in the ice right below it, which is quite interesting. And some of the other things that people aren't aware of is Billy Myers' case is that there were five assassination attempts on his life over there. At one time, when Colonel Stevens was over there visiting Billy Myers, they were shot at by a .30 caliber rifle, and the bullet just missed his head. And it was quite interesting because the guy took off and everything. But as in time, Billy Meyer kind of got hardened by all this. At one point, I think in the second event that happened after he had been going through these contacts, one of his daughters got kidnapped, but they finally got her back. So he went through some really powerful events because of his revelations, to the world about what he was doing. He was just trying to help humanity, but in the later years, he sort of got hardened by this, like I could see how possible it is. It's one reason why I've never really pursued it that much, other than the fact that I've had the experience and I've been using the. I don't really feel it was my job to make the world aware of the fact that I was involved with a UFO contact. It was more of my job to just work with the science and let it go at that. And then they also, in 1976, I think, during about the 46th meeting, he was given some metal samples. And the metal samples were given to IBM up in San Jose, and the guy, scientist that looked at them was a friend of mine. His name is Marcel Vogel. He was a senior scientist with them. And they looked at it under a 600-power microscope, and they put the specimen under a polarized cross-light field to begin to look at the structures. And lower magnifications, you'd see a metallic surface, but when you get into these higher magnifications, you see a structure. It was composed of many different interlacing areas, and the metals that the thing they found in it was one of the elements they found in the metal sample was a material called thulium, and we only worked with that here during World War II, where we refined it in small quantities, and Billy had a pretty large amount of it, and also within thulium they found some bromium, which was also in there, and a small trace of silver and argon. And I'll just read a quick quotation here, what Marcel Vogel said in a scientific report to the scientific community. He said, Right now, I could not explain the type of material that I have and its discreteness behind by my any known combination of materials. I could not put it together myself as a scientist. To get a combination of thulium, silver, and silicon in discrete areas, yes. If I were to meld it together, I would see the evidence of all of them, but their discreteness is what intrigues me. You understand what I'm saying? Because, you see, if I would take these combinations of materials and put them in a furnace, meld it, pour it out, and pull a little ingot, I would see all these elements present there in any one area. But I don't in these. I see discrete bits of material. Now, if it can only happen by some form of cold fusion process, where you have the elements present and you fuse them together so they maintain pure identity, but they interpenetrate one another. Now, we, with any technology that I know of, could not achieve this on Earth, planet Earth. It is very exciting when you get a specimen like this and have an opportunity of looking and examining them. It doesn't look like anything that we've made here. That was his comment, and other scientists in other areas had made the same comments. And the materials that they use in their ship are a cold fusion process. They use seven different stages of metal formation. And they never gave us the all seven stages because they said it was the technology that we weren't ready for yet. But it's a little bit lighter than titanium, but many times stronger and not as explosive. Titanium, because I work with it with the pyramids sometimes, because we make a pyramid out of titanium, it's very hard to weld. You have to have heliarching. It's a very expensive material to work with. And it's very hard to make a welded joint last for any length of time because it has a tendency to unfuse itself. Whereas working with a cold metal process, it works a little bit different, and that's what they use. Also, they have on their technology, they have a technique of growing things. They can grow certain plants in certain shapes and then put some kind of a process on them once they're harvested, and they can actually become components. And that's quite interesting, you know, studying that. And their computers are a little bit different than ours, too, which they use in their propulsion systems. Their computers are somewhat bionic as well as a hard analytical and digital type design. And bionic in the fact that they sense human feelings. And it's not that hard to do because our technology here on Earth is fast beginning to, you know, approach that form of technology. For example, at Wright-Patterson Air Force Base, they were teaching rats logic by putting rats in a maze, connecting a computer to the rat, and letting the computer work with the rat as the rat figured its way out of the maze. And then later on, they would program the computer in the maze, and different mazes, and the computer would actually, in its own way, logically, begin to search, as the rat did, for a way out of the maze. So this form of technology I found quite interesting. Now, I have this huge telescope because of my ongoing contact with Semyasi. She asked me to get a telescope because I'm writing a book now. And while we're talking here, I'll basically run through my notes. I don't like to read too much of the stuff because this is coming out in another book. But I can, let me see here. Yeah, here we go. This was back on Mother's Day in 1980. Every conversation I ever had with her, I always documented the time, I mean the date. And we were having a whole big long conversation, but and the moment I lose you on this, you stop me, and I'll reiterate, okay? But the first thing we were talking about.
Fair enough, but go slow, okay?
Right. The first part of this is one, two, about four paragraphs. But you got to understand when they speak to us, they're so intense that what they can say in a paragraph, an entire book could be written about it, and so. We were talking about the spaceships, and we were talking about relativity, and then, see, when I'm speaking to her, it's so intense that I can usually only talk to her for maybe 6 minutes, 7 minutes at the most, and then she loses me. I mean, I get lost. I just can't deal with it anymore because she goes right over my head. But, so we're coming from one conversation, and we're going to another, and I'll try to reiterate the questions as I ask them. But we were talking about the propulsion systems and fire. Because I noticed this glow that they have. She says, our spaceships, though physical, become living flames in flight. When you fly the astral plane, both sides are pure. Now, what that means is, the astral plane is when you go up in the relativity speeds, I'm interjecting here, when you accelerate consciousness or you accelerate anything up beyond the speed of light, you immediately transmute over to the astral plane. Same thing happens, there was a really good special, by a medical special 2 nights ago on television where they were showing and talking about people that would be dead temporarily for maybe 2 or 3 hours and then come back to life and the experience that they would have. And what usually happens is when their person dies, their frequency of their body, their vibratory frequency of their body, increases many, many times. And this one lady had fallen down and broke, hit her head, and she was pronounced dead for several hours and then came back to life. And what happens is because her momentum had accelerated at such a high rate of speed, she found out she was walking around, she saw herself, and then she was able to put her hand through the wall. She went to call on the phone for help, you know, and she put her hand went right through the phone because she was in her astral body. Well, the same thing happens with these spaceships when they go up in frequency. They go up on the astral plane and they become, their energy is faster than the speed of light. And when they say both sides are pure, what they mean is you have to go through a purification process to reach that space. Even though there are conflicting energies on the astral plane, they are not as gross as they are here on this plane that we're in. Then she says, both good and evil dwell as deep space denizens. Only purpose is a sign of progress. We fly with purpose, and when we lose it, as in old age, it is immediately regained by the supersoul of the universe. Our individuality is never lost. Whether we work for God or against God, it matters not, for we are all of God, and our forms preserve our common quest in search of the unmanifest. And at this point, I says to her, Sannyasi, I says, if you guys are out there, because I was asking her what happens when they die, because what happens, as she explains it, that each one of these people has a mission in life, and the ones that fly in these ships around the universe are like pioneers, and when they get to a certain age, the ship is destroyed, you know, because they miscalculate, or, you know, the pilot's like 800 or 900 years old. So she was explaining that they go into the super soul, they become part of everything, you know, which totally agrees with this thing was the other night, because this lady says after she quit wandering around looking at herself out of her body, then she became aware of going into a tunnel and seeing these lights manifest, and she knew that the lights were part of her. She also said that she knew that when every soul was going to leave the earth and when every soul was going to enter the earth. This was all in a medical special 2 nights ago on TV. It was great, you know, and I totally agreed with what Sannyasi said. So then I said to Sannyasi, I said, now look, if you guys are going into a new area, as I watch Star Trek too, you know, how do you know whether the occupants are good guys or bad guys when you go into this area? And she answered, the dark powers of the universe are easily discerned. They are in search of the manifest. So what she was saying is that any time a race is seeking something that's physical, and that is their quest, they are a dark force.
There you have that part of that section of that tape, and that should make up the missing link, hopefully, anyway. And now what we're going to do is, I like their explanation of death, and it's different because it's a transition, and there's some interesting stuff going on. I remember one time I was talking to her about Wright Patterson, and she said some of the ships had been captured over there, and the beings had been chirogenically frozen. So they were in their astral bodies. So anytime the ships came in that were non-captured near Wright-Patterson Air Force Base, they could make contact with the astral form of these four trapped Pleiadians, but they were powerless to do anything about it beyond that. So that is a different form of purgatory as far as I'm concerned. Anyway, that's how that tape goes. And now we're going to move right on into the next little thing right here. And this will be another show that might have got crossed over. And we're eventually going to have all this stuff properly organized, but at least we're getting it up here in the archives now, so you can skip around and listen to the shows and have some fun. And of course, I'm sure Dr. Bell is just, you got the music going, here comes that famous crazy guy. I think Dr. Bell is on again, hopefully. Some more.
Look at that guy. And your talk alternative now continues with Dr. Fred Bell's Health Science.
I'll check out. Let the previous Dr. Bell take over. I love this. Two Dr. Bells. There's a third one coming.
And here is live from Redondo Beach, Jim.
Hello, Dr. Bell.
How are you doing today?
I'm fine. How are you doing?
Oh, having fun.
Having fun.
The rains have come and gone.
We're having rains again right now as we speak. Isn't this a sink for the evening?
And we're looking for more rain tomorrow.
We need more rain tomorrow. It's smog.
Almost flooded out here in Laguna Beach yesterday.
You see lots of smog out over Newport today.
Now, where does that come from around that area?
Morning traffic. Right now, there's an inversion right there. It's about a 4,000-foot inversion happening, just looking out over the mountain here. And so all this morning traffic that we had was clear yesterday, and then the morning last night's traffic and this morning's traffic pushed that smog out into the atmosphere, that automobile exhaust, and right now it's turned sulfur dioxide because it's the right color, and it's changing. And it's not going anywhere because there's a cold layer above the warm layer at the bottom. We got the warm layer here at the bottom from the sun, and then the cold layer up higher, so that pressure of the cold is holding the warm air in wind plow. The high pressure area. You can see it. Isn't that wonderful?
Yes, wonderful.
We'll build a great big ionizer and put it out there, you know?
Well, that's what I've suggested now. Well, of course, tomorrow we're expecting more rain, so that should help.
Yeah, it'll be green again tomorrow for a little while anyway. The rain's been a lot of fun. We're getting back. We haven't had this much rain in quite a while. We only had one rainstorm last year.
Yes.
And also it was hot last year this time. It's cold this year. So we're getting some cool weather now, too. Be interesting to see how long it stays cool, though. I like to go skiing if it stays, you know. I guess it's snowing pretty good now, too, up north in the mountains.
I understand it is, yes.
Yeah. Anyhow, my tape guy came over yesterday, and I got a lot of calls from people to do a seminar, just a heavy-duty seminar. And I've been really kind of busy to do a seminar, and I'm not motivated to do seminars on things that I've done seminars on in the past. So what I put together here is, well, actually my tape, I have a guy that does my tapes. He edits everything I do. Is I have 6-part series on a complete seminar of seminars that I've done in the past. And these are not tapes that are available. You know, these are not things that I've done on K-Fox. These are things that I've done in lecture halls all over the country, actually all over the world. And the tapes come with
make those 6 tapes available through Blog and Service at no charge. So those will be coming, and you'll see it as a Paradigm tape series from the 80s, 6 shows each. Dr. Bell, that other guy, he just helps me out so much these days.
That I'd forgotten about, that I used to bring out a lot in my lectures and seminars. And so what I'd like to do real quick is read off the subtitles, and then these will be available for those of you that want it. To hear a seminar. This is about the closest thing that I'm doing right now in the way of seminars, but it's probably more complete than a seminar because it's a compilation in a linear manner of all the seminars I've done the last 5 or 6 years. The first one, series number one, it's called the Seminar 1980 Series. It's a personal background, talks about the American Revolution, the colon, digestion, minerals and vibration, electricity and magnetism. And then on side two, it's a continuation of that. It's quite an interesting thing. When I go into the American Revolution, I used to cover a lot of ground on the spiritual and metaphysical side of the American Revolution, how it relates to the third eye on the dollar bill, because a lot of my ancestors were participants in the American Revolution. The second tape is ionization, air pollution, the pyramid principle, pyramid energy and the effects, and detoxification during sleep. And what that goes into is sleeping inside the pyramid, which I briefly mentioned on K-Fox here from time to time. And the third tape of the series is genetic mutation, minerals in the nervous system, the aura, mutual induction, and Carillion photography, which is quite interesting. And these are all tied together. They're not separate subjects. They're all interrelated. And the next one, the fourth tape, is ions and hemoglobin, pyramid energy and the vitality globule, detoxification, and we talk about what's called friendly headaches, vibration, and hormones. And the next one, which is number 5, is entitled Venusian Consciousness, New Pyramids and Altered Hormones and Altered States, Superphysical Abilities, Systems, Time Travel, and Levitation. And that's one that Jim would probably like to get his hands on, part 5.
Now, I'm wondering about this Venusian tape. What's that?
Well, the Venusian tape... there are different levels of consciousness on this planet, and right now we are coming into what's called the Christ consciousness, or Christ consciousness, whereby we begin to be concerned with other people and other, you know, problems that are in the world, you know, like feeding, starvation, all these kinds of things. So we're concerned. There's a genuine worldwide concern about this, and efforts are being made to alleviate some of the world problems of hunger and famine and disease and pestilence and all of the other things that we have. That's Christ consciousness. That's the male aspect of planet Earth. Venusian consciousness goes into the study of the, it's called the Venusian or Pyramid of the Moon, which is down in Mexico, and I have about a half an hour on that, and its relationship to the planet Venus. Now, planet Venus is the Earth's alter ego. It's 5/8 the mass, for example, of the planet Earth, which is about the same relationship as a female, the mass of the female versus the masses of the average male, the weight, density, size, volume, you know, coefficient. So it's a comparison of all that type of thing, but at the same time showing the feminine aspect of the universe, which is the next state of consciousness beyond Christ consciousness. That is seen by the women coming more and more into power today and for political reasons. It's seen in a more accelerated state by visitations of female cosmonauts from other galaxies. It's seen on the upside down part of the Star of David, the inverted part. It's seen by the inverse, what the pyramid does when the pyramid is held upside down over a person's head, or the top pyramids on the receptor. All of these are triggers that release the ego from its bondage, allowing the spirit to consciously understand what the feminine aspect of the universe is. And this, of course, brings you into the superphysical world. This is called Venusian consciousness. And this is all explained in this tape. Consciousness beyond Venusian consciousness are not for us for at least thousands of years yet, but they do exist. There's one called the Saturian consciousness, which has to do with planetary schools and teaching and things like that. That's not on this tape, but just showing you that these are all aspects of what are called planetary schools by metaphysicians. And, of course, astrologers like Farley, he doesn't talk about this stuff too much.
You can also email me if you want me to bring these tapes out earlier. The Venusian consciousness is a very good one. I think I did some work with Saturian masters, but email me. I'll line these up in the show lineup earlier than I normally would if there's interest. Any subject you might have, by the way, that comes to your mind, I have an archived tape. I'll bring that out on a show prematurely. Plus, my late night show will be covering a lot of this stuff, too.
Reincarnation, evolution, and then a question and answer session at the end of the tape. So that constitutes a lot of things that I've done in the past. And these tapes would be available for $49.95. Just, you know, call me here at Pyridyne anytime. We'll send them out. They are currently ready for shipment now. The next series of tapes that I'm doing, we're going to edit down all of the K-Fox tapes that I've done in the last 6 months, and we're going to have a series of those available too. Plus, I'm going to have you play some of these tapes from time to time over on the station. You know, I'll bring you up a complete set, so that there's days that I'm not able to come on the air, you'll have some really what I concentrated information. So it should be fun. We're getting more organized now, and that's important for the next year, because as soon as some of these things that are standardized, I won't have to be so repetitive on some of these subjects, which then will give me a freedom to go off into new subjects. So what I'll probably do is alternate between subjects that that need to be repeated for new listeners, plus we'll go into a more advanced subjects for our regular listeners, because I'm sure some of the regular listeners have heard some repetitiveness that we've had to go through. But in this kind of, when you're talking about science and we're constantly picking up a lot of new listeners, like I know we are, very important to repeat, and people just have to be aware of that. And then each audience, of course, will only assimilate so much knowledge anyway. Well, yesterday we were talking about the new nuclear disk that we've developed.
Dr. Bell, before you get into that, we do have a call on the line.
Okay.
Why don't we go to that rather than interrupt you when you get in the middle of your topic?
Okay.
Let us go to line four right now. On line four, we've got Greg. Greg, you're on the air with Dr. Fred Bell.
Yeah, hi, Doctor. How you doing?
Yeah, very appropriate you said about repeating yourself. I have a question this morning about the ionizers.
Right.
Yeah. You know, now you said that, is that the stainless steel emitting needle, is that the one that corrodes?
No, the ones that corrode were the ones that we never used. They were ones made, they were a steel fuzz that a lot of companies use. There was one that was called a fuzz buster or something, I don't know, fuzz ball or something like that. That it was a ball of steel wool on top of a ionizer. That one corroded, and there are ordinary iron and steel emitters would corrode
We use a cloth-type material or a gold emitter, you know, or we would use a stainless steel. I haven't used even stainless steel in a long time. We went to gold-plated, and then we dropped it all together, and we went to a silver-bearing material.
Yeah, I saw a product with a stainless steel needle, and I just wanted to check it out with you just to know if that kind of emitter needle is okay to be used.
Well, yeah, it's okay. It's archaic in the fact that the conductivity of a stainless steel needle is nowhere near a gold-plated one. The best ones that we ever did when we were doing that was a gold-plated brass needle. It was the best one that we had the best results with.
Yeah.
Stainless steel is usually inexpensive because you can go down and buy a bunch of needles and cut the end off of them. That's probably what that is. They bought a bunch of sewing needles and then they cut them in half. That's normally what's done because it's a cheap and dirty way to get a fairly reliable needle on a machine.
Yeah, okay, great. Well, you know, I'm working with Paul. You don't remember Paul? He came down and bought some stuff from you?
Trying to.
Shepard? Paul Shepard?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, and I'm just, you know, he's trying to work a unit into his thing.
Yeah, that'll be nice. Paul, by the way, Jim, is the one that was Debbie Kenna's guest on. He works for Christopher Hill via the Spirulina.
Oh, yes, I remember Paul.
Yeah, and Paul's now interested in integrating the ionization in with the Spirulina because Spirulina is like increasing the effectivity of the oxygen capabilities of within the body and the protein structures and the mineral structures, and the ionizer enhances the effect of Spirulina. So it makes it really good in combination.
Yeah, well, good. Well, I wanted that information so I could talk intelligently about it when we discuss this so we can do some good things maybe with your unit.
Yeah.
It obviously is the most dynamic unit, I think, on the market today, down here anyway.
Oh, yeah, our ionizer, there isn't even a close second in the world right now. There's a unit that sells for the same price as ours out of Canada now called Bioneer. And it's a fairly reliable unit, but it, like most units, does not have enough high voltage to really do anything. You've got to have 20 or 30,000 volts in your power supply to deliver ionization across the room into somebody's lungs.
Right.
And you also have to have electrostatic filters to remove all the dirt and bacteria, especially this time of year, from the air. Like, I was flat on my back about a week ago because I my usual upper respiratory attack that I get in,
uh-huh,
looks like a subclinical form of bronchitis. As soon as I turned the ionizer on in one evening, my lungs were cleared out, and they've been clear ever since. So now's the time of the year to really get heavy in ionization.
You know, some of the record companies have been... I can't hear you too well, so I don't know if I'm interrupting you. I think I'm okay here, right?
Yeah.
They're ionizing the jackets, so when you pull the jackets off, you know, it takes the dust right off the record?
Right.
Yeah. Well, could a person do the same thing somehow, like, for riding a bicycle?
What, with a jacket?
I don't know. You know, like, take a bicycle helmet, you know, and because masks are really uncomfortable to wear, but extend something down from the face of it, ionize it somehow so you don't have to breathe all that stuff.
No, you could, but you could only put a filter in. You got to realize that any kind of dusting of a record is done with positive ions, not negative ions, static charges.
Uh-huh.
If you're on a bicycle, you'd have to have it ground to the earth.
Uh-huh.
You only create positive, because what happens when you move something through the air and it creates a static charge and it's insulated from the earth is a positive charge, because all the electrons give themselves up to air friction much more readily than the proton, because they're 1,600 times lighter than a protein, just in charge alone, mass alone, rather.
Yeah, I've really been becoming aware of how I'm sucking in that gas fumes while I'm riding my bike to work, and it's just...
Well, what you should do is get one of our battery-powered ionizers and just extend the emitter up to some area ahead of your helmet or whatever. Now, you know, I went back... One thing that was interesting that I remembered when I was talking in my... I was listening to my seminar tapes last night, and we were talking about altered states, and there were two or three things that I had... subjected, by wearing pyramids over a period of time, it produces an altered state of consciousness. And there were two things that I had gotten involved with. One was a form of self-mastery called Tummo, whereby in Tibet, when you do Tummo, you sit out in the Himalayan mountainside in the middle of the night, and they put these sheets over you, and they pour hot water on them, and they freeze, and then they put another sheet on you, they pour hot water on that, and it freezes. And the idea is to, once you have got so many sheets of ice over you, you know, there's water contained in a muslin sheet, is to do rapid fire breathing and melt all the ice off in the middle of the night when it's 20 below zero. Well, I got into this form of exercise several years ago and was practicing this up at Mammoth. And this was back when I was had a very strict dietary principle. I was doing a lot of exercise, much more physical, rigorous shape than I was in now, plus very high, strong extremes of discipline. And the body will adjust to this over a period of time. Well, I got into the second form of altered state practice, which was called Gompa running. And Gompa running is where a runner will run approximately 250 miles a day, and your gaze is concentrated over the horizon, and you're running about 20 to 25 miles an hour. So I was getting into this after the Tummo, and I was able to run almost 25 miles an hour, which is quite fast. And you are doing what I call a super physical breathing exercise, as well as a gating exercise, as well as you're running over the horizon. If you were to look down at your feet or break your gaze for 1 second, you'd fall on your head because it's all coordination. And you're breathing what I would call a second wind continually. It's an altered state, and it's really fun to do. And I got into it, and there was about three of us that were training for this. And you can run for great long periods of time because you're basically hyperventilating and you're breathing pure prana rather than oxygen. But what happened to me was, as I was getting good at it, I started practicing here in Laguna Beach. And as thin as the air is here and as dirty as it is, and it's probably a lot cleaner here than it is downtown Los Angeles or whatever, I found that after a period of time I had accumulated so many bacteria and viruses in my lungs that I almost died from it. It was amazing. I haven't been able to run like that since. Now I can run about 5 miles an hour because I came down with a tremendous chest and respiratory infection because I had supercharged all of this dirt and garbage way into my lungs because the lung cavity expands. It becomes huge when you practice this form of running, this form of meditation. So to make a long story short, the altered states were a whole lot of fun to practice, both the Tummo and the Gompa running, but in the environment that we live in now, it's so polluted. Unless you're in the Himalayas or somewhere where the air and the atmosphere is clean, they're senseless to practice. I should have had ionization, but even more, I didn't filter it.
Do you think you're much safer in a car with ionization?
What?
Are you much safer in a car with ionization?
Yeah, you're a lot safer in a car with ionization.
Yeah.
But it's unfortunate that we really can't practice some of these altered state things that are physical. We've done like spoon bending and all that kind of stuff, levitation. Those are relatively safe, but they open you up for psychic pollution.
Uh-huh.
So you really have to be aware of what you do until the whole world gets cleaned up more. We all kind of got to stay in the same bathtub, you know.
Uh-huh. Did you see Bill Murray's latest movie?
Which was the name of that?
Well, it's his first dramatic role. He goes up to the Himalayas and he sits up. They give him his books, and he has to go sit up underneath a little open type of roof. And as it gets colder and colder, he has to quit reading his books, and then he has to burn them.
Uh-huh.
And then he has to sit there and freeze.
I haven't seen that one.
Yeah, you should see it. You'd probably like it. He was pretty good in it. It was his first dramatic role. A lot of people criticized him for it, but I forget what the name of it was. But check it out. It's still out, I think.
Okay.
Good luck. Fine. Okay, well, thanks for your information.
Greg, thank you very much for calling.
Bye-bye.
This is the Dr. Fred Bell Health Science and Energy Show, and Dr. Bell, we're going to continue, but first I want to take a short time out for a subject that is near and dear to you, and that is Excalibur. And we'll be right back after this. The name is Excalibur. Excalibur, the world's finest nutritional supplement for the 80s that you've heard Dr. Fred Bell speak of so often, is now available to you at a super low price. Only $14.95. Excalibur is a synergistically formulated supplement that took years to develop and guarantees maximum assimilation within the body. Most supplements meet only part of your nutritional needs, but Excalibur is a full-spectrum nutritional supplement. Don't settle for second best when you can have Excalibur. Order today by calling area code 714-499-2603. That number, 499-2603. Or write to Excalibur, 891 Santa Ana Street, Laguna Beach, California, 92603. Remember, don't settle for second best when you can have Excalibur. And we are back on the Dr. Fred Bell Health Science and Energy Show. Dr. Bell?
Oh, thank you, Jim. Anyhow, yesterday we were talking about the different gemstones in the receptors and some of the more powerful uses of them and how that they work in the body and what how they are combined with the receptor itself. And one of the gems that, of course, we talked about the ruby, it was the sapphires we were just getting into, because probably the most popular ones that we have are the diamond and the emerald and the sapphire and probably the amethyst. And the sapphire was noted as a regal gem back in the days of chivalry and the kings and queens. And believe it or not, there's a dispute between when Moses was up on the mountain and was getting the Ten Commandments. Some of the historians say that they were engraved on tablets of sapphire, and others say that they were engraved on lapis lazuli. So one or the other, they're both interrelated because they're both dark blue and violet stones. So the sapphire was also considered an antidote against poison back in the medieval times, and similar to the emerald, which we discussed yesterday. And we use the sapphire primarily in a receptor that has to do with the heart, the areas of the heart, and relaxation. We find that when the sapphire is worn in the form of a receptor, if you have any kind of cramping in your body or any kind of pain in your body, it's very good for the relief of pain and relaxation. It also has a tendency, I think, to strengthen the heart, especially if you're taking it with something like Excalibur, which has large amounts of B15 in it, because when we were wearing the pyramids, for example, when you would wear a pyramid on your head like a fire dome and take vitamin C, the assimilation factors of the body with vitamin C in the presence of the pyramid were quite higher. And yesterday after we were talking on the show, a friend of mine came down, the guy that does the tapes, and he bought one of these nuclear discs, which is like the receptor minus the gemstone on it. And he had come up with an idea, a use for it, that I thought I'd share with you today. And that is in the reverse osmosis units that people are now using out there to take care of their water. Once the water goes through the reverse osmosis unit, in his case, he had a little storage tank that some of the water was in. He put the nuclear disc in the little water tank. And immediately, evidently, an RO unit doesn't do the most wondrous things for the flavor of the water. But what he said is with the nuclear receptor disc in there, not the receptor, but the disc itself, in the water storage area of the reverse osmosis unit, it made the water taste like mountain fresh spring water. And it really was a whole lot, he felt a real definite vitality principle coming from the water. So this is an area that we're really getting into now with the receptor in water. Now, we haven't integrated the gemstones into the other unit yet, but it is possible to do that. Right now, we're primarily using the gemstones for human health and human consciousness and human protection, you know, for the aura field. So, the research is starting to prove out new things or new applications and new ideas. Now, the other stone that we use a lot of course, is the amethyst. The amethyst is a very popular stone, and it has been thought of by the ancients, much like the emerald, the amethyst will quicken the intelligence and, you know, it says, render men shrewd in business matters. And the amethyst worn on a person had a sobering effect, not only about those who have partaken too freely, as it says here, the cup that intoxicates, but also about those ever excited by love passion. And also it said it preserved the soldiers from harm and gave them victory over their enemies and was of great assistance to hunters in the capture of wild animals. The amethyst shared many of the other stones the power to preserve the wearer from any kind of negative effects. So it's interesting to look back down through history, and I've been doing studies going back as far as, let's say, 3,000 years, to see how the ancients used these different stones. And so when people out there, they call me or they want to know what stones to wear and what stones not to wear, if you just take into consideration some of the ancient uses of them, and some of them probably are definitely superstitious, but the fact is there are continual references, for example, to the emerald towards intelligence. There are continual references towards the amethyst towards creativity. There are continual references towards the sapphires towards relaxing the body. And it goes on and on and on. So these the stones alone would do that, but in the presence of a form of energy that removes the electrical precursing principles of a stone, because that's primarily what we're dealing with in the body, is the pre-electricity state, or the state just before metabolic changes begin to happen. And if we're addressing that state, that's the state that is normally hurt by stress, it's hurt by toxins. So it's a natural place to put the stone and the pyramid together in a shape that will, you know, provide some substance to the wearer.
Dr. Bell, we are just about out of time
for today. Dr. Bell.
So anyway,
Dr. Bell, I can't believe you're taking me off the air.
Available for a dollar. Just give us a call at 714-499-2603. All right, Dr. Bell, 891 Santa Ana Street, Laguna Beach, 92651.
And we look forward to hearing more from you tomorrow on the Dr. Fred Bell Health Science and Energy Show.
Very good. I'll be listening to you throughout the day also, Jim. Have a nice day.
You too. Bye-bye, Doctor.
Bye-bye.
That was the end of another one of those shows. So we get a bonus this evening. You get a bonus. We're going to toss in a third show. Oh, an hour and a half of Dr. Bell. About an hour and 20 minutes, I guess. So that's what's coming up. And I'm going to do some 90-minute shows, too. Just to back up the archives. But there's a lot of information. That stuff on the amethyst is really interesting in the fact that I've used those. The amethyst receptor makes people very, very powerful in business. And also, if you're going through a divorce or you're looking for a girlfriend or a boyfriend, they work there too. Because they set your aura up to receive. Of course, you have to believe in order to receive, I've always said. But these things do work in a very effective way, because that show was like 20 years ago, and we've been selling a lot of receptors, and I bet in 20 years we haven't had more than half a dozen come back. People didn't get results, and the ones that sent them back later on probably regretted it. And, you know, we're moving into the last show now here for the evening. God, I love the music. Just, you never get enough of Dr. Bell, do you? At least I don't. What an ego. I sit and look at myself for hours in the mirrors, and then I shoot the mirror.
Now it's my pleasure to say,
with a ray gun.
Good morning, Dr. Fred Bell.
Here he is again every morning.
How are you this morning?
I am fine.
I did this for a whole year.
You probably don't know. You probably didn't feel it down there.
7 days, 6 days, 5 days a week.
We suffered an earthquake here in the South Bay.
Oh, we had an earthquake on this one.
You know what happened when you guys were, when you were
the earthquake special.
About that. You know how we sit in the studio and sometimes the waves shake it a little bit?
Yes.
Was it a lot harder than that?
It was much harder than that. And then we got calls throughout the last hour from people saying that they had felt the earthquake also through some areas of the Southland here.
Yeah, well, you know, when you guys were, I was listening to the show because you were talking about abortions and that this morning, you know, and ultrasound. And so I was listening to the show, and exactly when you said that, there was a mirror hanging on the wall that started moving back and forth. I didn't actually feel the earthquake, but it actually caused the mirror to move back and forth here in Laguna.
Well, I called Caltech, and I'm trying to get in more information concerning it as far as the epicenter goes and the strength of the earthquake. So hopefully we will have that for everyone soon.
Yeah. So how'd you guys, today, by the way, we can take call-ins. We're not going out into space today.
Okay. If you have a question or a comment for Dr. Fred Bell regarding some of the subjects he discusses here, our number is 772-5718 or 316-KFOX. I'd like to hear some comments from people that did the meditation yesterday and see how they reacted to it.
Yeah, because it's fun to get feedback. You know, doing it on the telephone, you know, through the station back out into the airwaves, there was a lot of power flowing through here yesterday. I'll tell
yes.
you, feel it. Yes. That earthquake was just a little residual because they were getting ready for today's energy blast, you know?
I don't know. It is interesting. I want to find out where that epicenter was. Maybe it was located relatively near. I mean, it was a sharp little quake here that we felt. But again, I don't know how close we were to the epicenter.
We'll get into that later on. One of my next subjects up and coming is going to be the subject of volcanoes.
Oh, okay.
Studies on those now. But that'll be a fun series, too. But anyway, what I want to do is I want to discuss a little bit more today of what we've been doing for the last week. Basically, the energy systems in the body in the what I call the primary state, plus the effects of the receptor on those states and the pyramids and that. And yesterday, we in the meditation, I don't know if you remember the words per se that I was saying, but you remember basically what we were doing, right?
Yes. We were moving energy from the lowered chakras up to the higher.
Right.
And what I wanted to do today was describe just a, kind of an intellectual description of that, of what was actually happening, which I think would be fun for everybody. And first of all, this exercise and what we did yesterday is in my book, Death of Ignorance. This comes out of the middle part of the book, pages 134, 135. It's something I put back together back in the 70s. We used to use it in our classes. And you can really, there's a lot more you can do with it. Some people have actually, when you do it with a Kundalini exercise that goes with it, it's a form of Kundalini yoga, it's possible to blindfold someone and put like a, you put a tin can on their head or a bucket or something so they couldn't see out. And then they go through the exercise, they do the visualizations accompanied with about 1,000 fire breaths. It's rapid breathing, and I don't recommend you try it until you train for it. But you can actually see without your eyes. You can see all around your body. It's a very incredible experience that you can actually develop, because after you go through all these, like I would call hallucinatory effects and these showers of lights from the different chakras, you can actually, all of a sudden, you illuminate the outside of your body. And what's happening is the etheric part of your body will transmit energy directly into the pineal pituitary glands, and because they do have optic-type cells around them, they will illuminate a portion of your brain, so the outer sensitivity of your etheric body, registering all the light and sound and colors, will present visual images. And if you center yourself on it, you'll center yourself right in the room that you're doing it, and you can see all the way around your body, 360 degrees. It's quite incredible. That's what we actually developed it to back in the early 70s when I was working with this stuff all the time. I spent about 3 years of my life just working with Kundalini yoga. Previous to that, I had gotten into martial arts, which was great exercise, but I just wasn't quite releasing my mind into my body like I wanted it to. So anyway, yesterday what we were doing is we were becoming aware of the energy coming into our bodies from the inner planes of consciousness, which transmits itself all over the universe. And basically the energy comes in at the base of the spine, and it comes in, imagine like a wheel with four spokes in it, and the energy comes in at the center of the spokes on one direction and forms like a basket weaving network around the spoke as it splits up and disperses itself. And this is sort of, if you were like putting a basket worker weaving a thread through the spokes of a bicycle, for example, that's how the energy is working on these chakras. And the further up the spine that you go, the more weaves that takes place, the more interlacing between the cosmic forces and the universe, the seven basic rays, as we call them, and the physical body. So each one is a higher sense of consciousness with more and more visual things to experience. But what I'd like to do is just read, now that we're not actually in the exercise, just read a couple of things real quick right out of the book, so that it clearly puts things in place before I continue on. I've written that every human on this planet is out of balance in one way or another. So as energy from a balanced universe such as ours strikes our bodies, entering through our bodies at the point shown in the following drawings, which I've drawn here, which we described yesterday, the exact moment it encounters an imbalanced body, it is put into a state of temporary shock. Now what that means is that the universe, the relationship between the sun and the moon, the relationship between the heavens and the earth, and the relationship between the earth and the solar system and the Pleiades, the energies that flow back and forth are natural and pretty much in balance. As a matter of fact, they're dictating some pretty awesome things that happen. And our bodies are typically out of balance to a degree that we're existing in them, because no person that I've ever met has ever been even close to perfection. We're all in various stages of perfection. I feel that we're all equal, but some of us have been working a little longer than others, and some of us a little bit further down towards the path of perfection than others, but we're all ending up in the same place. The fact is, at this point in time, we're trying to maintain an awareness, and we have been given the freedom to express our egos any way we want and do whatever we want with the physical forms. We can take good care of it. We can abuse it. We can do a mixture of abuse and taking care of it like most of us do. So what happens is, in these chakra points in the body, when this is going on, it shocks the body. The body is actually getting a shock, a temporary shock, like an earthquake. And this shock, of course, is like the waking up of a baby taking its first breath. And it's a high form of energy, and each shock, it only lasts for about milliseconds, but it produces very, very, very effects on the body. First thing that happens is the primary energy comes in from the upper realm, and and it strikes into these different parts on the chakras. The shock lasts a split second, but basically what happens is life is sustained in our bodies and gravity is created. And then the sequence of that we went through, let's read it off so you can kind of reiterate on it, is that some of the energy balances, some of the energy balances perfectly sustaining life in the form, while some energy collides with the form. We're talking about the body now. So some of these energies that are striking us from the universe are in direct contradiction to our bodies because our bodies are not in a line. This area, these seven different points that we discussed yesterday, is called strike zone energy and causes fusion of three etheric zones. Now, remember we did Carillion photography that day, Jim?
Yes, sir.
Okay. That was photographing the three etheric zones. We have seven levels of consciousness, okay? The physical, the emotional or the astral, the mental, and it goes on and up set to seven levels. But just looking on the physical plane, we have solid, liquid, gas, and ionic, and three states of ether. These three etheric states are the realm of the nuclear particles that the physicists are all studying right now. Okay, so that's what we're talking about. So when this energy, the strike zone energy, causes this fusion of these three zones, and then what happens is once these three higher zones of the physical is affected by this etheric energy, then what happens is four levels of solids are created in our body. And this is where all form is created this way. And so what happens is when our bodies are breathing etherically, they're actually creating matter. And, of course, this takes place in the first stage of creation of matter is the fusion of the carbon atom and the marriage of the hydrogen atom. The hydrogen atom and the carbon atom are the first two to combine. And then the moment that those two combine and the life starts to happen, oxygen is brought in. So then we have nitrogen, which then helps return the cycle. So we have oxygen, hydrogen, nitrogen, and carbon. Now, we're working now with three gases. This fusion between the spiritual energy and the physical is working in the medium of three gases and one solid. The solid is the pyramid-shaped carbon atom within our bodies. And all of the carbon atoms in our body are, if they're in perfection, are pyramid-shaped. But what happens is a lot of times is that because, like we said earlier, that we are not in perfection, we ended up with a distorted shape. The atomic structure is not really coherent as it should be. So what happens is you have a distortion in the pyramid. And there's various forms of pyramidal distortion shown in 12 or 13 different pyramids over in Egypt. Each one is built differently. Each one is distorted. And each one of them is symbolic of the distortion from the master builders that built them because different people built these things. When we bring pyramid energy into our lives, what we do is we compensate for some of these distortions, and it reestablishes the geometric shape of the carbon atom in the body. So the receptor in the pyramid will reestablish this geometrical shape.
Dr. Bell, I'd like to interrupt for just a second. We do have word of the earthquake now. It did happen officially at 10:20 a.m. The epicenter was 16 miles southeast of Oxnard, and the magnitude was 4.6. I just wanted to pass that along.
Well, that's great, Jim. I'm proud of you. You're creating earthquakes now. I'll bet you that we're the first person of all the radio and TV stations in Southern California to announce it this morning.
Well, I don't know because I haven't listened to the others, but I do think it's important to keep on top of exactly where it was. Now, I don't know if there was any damage up in Oxnard. A 4.6 is a fairly strong jolt.
Well, you know, have you ever been explained what a magnitude means in an earthquake?
Well, I know that I don't know exactly what the definition is. I know that it is not linear. I know the scale is not linear. I know
it's
logarithmic. Right.
For example, if you had a 4.5 and you had a 5.5, a 5.5 would be about 10 times more powerful than a 4.5.
And a 6.5 would be 10 times more powerful.
No, it would be 100, about roughly 100.
No, it would be 10 times more intense than a 5.5.
Yeah, but you get up into the 7s and 8s. I once had a professor explain to me what a magnitude of 10 would be like. You know, on the scale, I said, what would a magnitude of 10? That's where the scale stops.
Mm-hmm.
And what he said is, it would be very simple. The way the ground would roll on a 10 is 1 minute you would be looking on in a valley, looking 1 mile straight up at another hill that had just formed. The next minute you would be 1 mile high on top of a hill looking into a 1 mile valley that had just formed.
Oh my goodness.
It's a 1 mile vacillation at the Earth's surface at a magnitude of 10. 1 mile. That's awesome. The G-forces alone, this would happen from second to second. the G-forces alone would crush a person.
You would be thrown right off the face of the earth.
I know. So that's where the scale stops. If we ever have a 10, then you won't have to worry about it because you know there won't be anything left. It's kind of exciting, isn't it?
Yes, it is. It is extremely fascinating.
But you know, an earthquake is what takes place in the body on a mini level when this energy, the spiritual energy, strikes our bodies. It shocks us into life. You ever find yourself falling? Like, a lot of times, accidents wake people up. You know, you get shocked into something. You fall asleep, you go into a dream, and then suddenly you woke up because you ran into something, and you fell off a ladder or something.
Sure.
You know? That's shock. That's the way our bodies respond. It's the ego getting out of the way of the spirit. You know?
Mm-hmm.
So anyway, we've just created these four levels of solids. And also, when this energy is coming in the body, realize that through the top of the head, the spiritual energy is coming in too simultaneously to help balance everything out. But the physical energy, which is the kundalini and the sexual reproductive energy, is coming in, entering in the lower parts of the body. So different parts of our body receive energies at different times. Like, for example, when we were studying the carbon atom, we did a model of it with the hemoglobin. And the hemoglobin, of course, is basically eight pyramids. You know, four pyramid structures, one right side up, one upside down, one right side up, one upside down, and repeated four times in the iron atom. When these are made out of iron, and they're in the red blood cell. And around these, of course, are all the polypeptides, not polypeptides, but all of the different protein structures that make up the entire hemoglobin source. I think there's like 579 amino acids or something involved, and there are two chains, two alpha chains and two beta chains. Well, this is a very complex thing, you know, makes up just the red blood cell in the body, which is the life force being carried through. But everything is like that. If you look in nature, you look in the body, how things live, how form sustains life, it's always the same principle. There are just different expressions, but it's always the same thing. Anyway, energy constantly permeates all forms this way and forms these patterns. If used at the various intersections where these strikes, you know, actually hit the body, It shows up like these little octahedrons. We used to make a structure called an orb that amplifies that effect. And next thing is, now, when spirit gets trapped into the form, because the spiritual energy comes in from the head centers, you know, as it gets trapped in the form, it awakens to a spontaneous desire to return to go back to the source, you know, once it experiences the form feeling itself. In other words, the spirit likes to feel the form in our bodies, and the form likes to receive the spirit. Now, what happens is if the body, as a form, meaning the body, is clear and moving with the spirit, it becomes lighter. But if the body is moving away from the spirit, it is caught in it, and it was called the desire of the lower nature, the energy will be trapped and the form becomes heavier. This is the spiritual thing that a lot of people have to realize when they get into dieting and weight control. Because if you don't balance your lives, when you know, a diet isn't going to be the solution to weight. It might take temporarily pounds off your body, but what happens is they'll just come right back on again unless you adapt your life to these changes. Now, the constant vacillation between the two natures constitutes gravity. Gravity is the interchange of energy from seven planes of consciousness. It is a mutual force causing a downward thrust to seven energies coming from the upward-inward direction of spirit. And what that means is very simple. Take the Earth's gravity. The Earth is pulling in spiritual energy just like the human body is. As a matter of fact, this energy in the Earth causes the chakra to turn. The Earth itself is a chakra. It's turning. It's a chakra in a greater spiritual presence in the universe. So it begins to rotate. And if you look at the next planet over from Earth, which is Venus, it's rotating and working on the same principle. And if you look inside our bodies, the way these chakras rotate, one goes clockwise, one goes counterclockwise, one goes clockwise, one goes counterclockwise. It's like if you looked them together as gears, they would be a perfect gear train.
Now, what about non-rotating celestial bodies?
Those non-rotating celestial bodies are bodies that are working on a higher spiritual plane and do not have any kind of physical energy to them at all. They are basically arid planets as far as we know. Earth and Venus, for example, work like a figure eight, working against each other.
But those bodies would still have a gravitational effect.
Oh, yeah, they still have a gravitational effect, but they're not transmitting the energy to sustain life on the physical plane. They are releasing the spiritual energy back higher, and they're maintaining. As a matter of fact, those bodies do have a gradual a gravity effect, but they're not dense. Like Jupiter and Saturn are not dense planets at all. Did you know that?
Yes, I did. Yes, I did. They have quite a large volume, but their actual density, which is mass per unit area, is relatively small.
Right. Now, what's happening, for example, in Jupiter is that, you know, first of all, there's an evolution that's taking place on the planetary level. At one time, Mars was believed to be a lot like Earth, and they studied the Martian history and how the rocks are and the amount of oxygen and iron in the surface and those kinds of things, and it appears that Mars lost its atmosphere because it appears that Mars had a high carbon dioxide level, which then released oxygen, which the Earth is in the process of doing. The Global 2000 report shows that. Then it also points out that the planet Jupiter is going towards where the Earth is. Eventually, Jupiter will solidify, its gravity will change, it will become a denser planet, and maybe some point, billions of years from now, it will be very much like the Earth. During this time, the Sun will even increase in size, too. And the Earth will become more like the planet Mercury out in front, and Mars will become more like Mercury, and so will the Earth, because the heating will increase. So this is a projected evolution of our particular universe. Mm-hmm. But it falls in line with the way the body works if you study the relationship between the two, because there obviously isn't any difference.
But, Dr. Bell, now, as far as Jupiter goes, Jupiter may not even have a surface to it, as I understand. Of course, the gravitational fields when you get closer to what might be the surface would be tremendously strong. But as I understand it, it is a very gaseous planet. Where would the heavier elements be coming from?
Okay, what would happen is as it collapsed, as it got smaller, it would begin to solidify. That was one projected theory that I'd studied.
But it would not have the mass to, for example, all heavier elements come from the center of stars when stars turn hydrogen into helium, and then they go on and they will reconvert those into heavier elements. You don't have the kind of gravitational field in Jupiter to convert the hydrogen in there to the heavier elements.
No, not as we know it now. But as the sun increases its intensity and the heat, the surface of the Jupiter goes up, then these kinds of gases and reactions can be created. It has to do with the expansion of the sun. That has to take place first. As our sun is a young star yet, as far as we know, as far as we've been able to see.
When it bloats into a red giant?
Yeah, it might. Or else we'll get a dwarf out of it and then freeze to death. Anyway, let me go on to this now. The constant vacillation between... Are you following what I'm saying here?
Yes, I am. I just had a few questions about that.
Okay. The constant vacillation between the two natures constitutes gravity. Okay, now we talked about that. Okay, now, also occurring in this zone that's creating gravity, you know, depending on how long the spirit is trapped by the form, determines how much gravity is there. Okay, now, you take, for example, aging process. Older people. Older people, oftentimes, that have been a certain weight heavier, begin to get more and more etheric, more and more lighter, not at home as often. We say they're spacey or, incoherent, but they're moving back onto the spiritual, and their gravity is changing. And the next thing that happens is when their gravity changes, their time changes, too. The relationship with time begins to become not as concrete as the one that we live in. And we say, oh, that person is senile or whatever. Well, they're just changing states. They're going in another dimension. There's really nothing wrong with that. It's a natural fact of evolution. They feel they've had enough time in this plane or this dimension, and they're moving into another one. So, also occurring in the strike zone where this energy is coming and going, okay, is some of the energy that's worked off karma or spent itself. Remember, energy is not destroyed or created or destroyed. It's just only transmuted. The coming and going in the striking zones in the bodies creates a rhythm, which we call time. Time is the vibratory exchange rate of spirit and matter. Motion is the movement of the divine will being split by desire. Gravity is the recombination of the desire ascending to spirit after its expression through form. Anti-gravity, detachment, or impartiality is created by mind when it is disciplined to be free of desire, thus free of time zone on a particular plane of consciousness. However, all the time on all planes is interpenetrable. Each of the seven planes has its own time zone. From our point of view, the higher the plane, the slower the time. The struck zone interchange can be seen as a fusion or return of the kundalini as spirit releases itself into form, creating time. The law of inertia causes a downward flow, and the effect is the attraction of physical to physical, a sort of bonding action. Basically, it's a sexual energy. In a highly developed individual, the organized force is a balance, is in balance and moves out and away from the physical and creates the anti-gravity state of consciousness. Control of this energy comes from the mind via the upper mental plane when the lower mind stands aside and allows the higher mind to reach the astral and physical bodies. And, of course, that's the discipline of yoga that we hear about all the time. Now, anti-gravity consciousness is being reached by people through various yoga disciplines, and a side effect of levitation is demonstrated. The yogis call this state of consciousness siddhi. In one area of public attention where this was happening is where people were taking advanced courses in transcendental meditation and are hopping and levitating in public, you know, demonstrations.
Have you seen this, by the way? I've never seen this.
Yes, I've seen it. Not only have I seen it, but what we used to do, I have a system called a System 3 that's talked about in this book in one of our scientific catalogs. And what we used to do is we used to levitate people in the audience. And when we would levitate them, we would float them up in the air. I used to do this. Someday we'll do it in one of my seminars, but it takes a balanced audience to do it.
I would love to see. That must be great.
It is. It's fun. What happens is the experience, when I usually have the person that's going to be levitated visualize themselves as a cloud. And then what we do is we take, you know, four people and we direct their energies into that one person. And that one person then lifts off and goes up over their heads. It's really fun to do. It's an incredible experience. And the people, when they come back and they come out of this little, like, a state of being, you know, they say, wow, what a ride, you know. They really enjoy it. But, you know, when I started building the System 3, which is a huge structure, it was before the time machine that was built. As a matter of fact, this is what led into the time machine, because it was during these studies that we began to understand how time works and how a person can become free of time and how they become lighter. And this, of course, led to the research that made the time machine happen in later times, because everything that's going on here is happening inside the human body. So what we were trying to do was figure out how this was happening and then duplicate it mechanically on the other side, you know, into the machine. And it was fascinating. When you came down to the house, remember those big tall structures you saw in the living room?
I'm not sure. No, of course I was...
Well, they had crystals in them. They were tall. There were four big structures in the living room there. Like,
well, you have so many crystals throughout the house, it's hard to know which ones you're referring to. You got that big one right there in the living room.
Right, well, around that were four columns, gold-plated pyramid columns.
Oh, wait a minute. The array of pyramids, you mean?
Yeah.
Yeah, I remember those, yes.
Okay, those are irradiators. We use seven of those. We use seven of those in a circle, and we would put people inside of them. What we would do is we would put the corresponding gemstone in the modulating chamber, so that array, each particular one of seven arrays, was vibrating at one of the chakra rates, which then caused one of the endocrine glands to secrete hormones. And so we would use one of the seven gemstones in a clockwise or a counterclockwise direction, going around the room, depending on what we were trying to accomplish. That was how System 3 works. Then what we would do is put the person in the middle of the system, and we would put them on a chair. And then what we would do is we had a 50,000 volt ion generator, a negative ionizer that connected to each one of these different irradiators and sent a rotational force field around it in a clockwise direction. And so you could just feel the wind alone, but it was a tremendous feeling in the body for this wind, this hot solar wind, this ion wind was created. And plus we had all these crystals grounding out these different units. But the entire structure then was elevated to 50,000 volts. It wasn't just sitting at a grounded potential. And each one of these one of seven machines then transmits a vibration determined by the series of gemstones that are in it into one of the seven different chakras. And by controlling the rate of vibration and the sequencing of the vibration, the chakras then talk or address the endocrine glands. The endocrine glands in the body, as we discussed before, secrete hormones in a linear fashion up into the head centers, into the brain. The brain then releases feelings that causes the body to do things like levitate or time travel. Because just as you have feelings in your body created by sexual attraction or energy from the adrenals, from exercise or meditation, any of those energies, they're all determined by a sequence of different kinds of hormones coming from the endocrine system. So in order to accomplish a feat like levitation or time travel, all you have to do is resequence the hormones once into the right field pattern that brings out that kind of a feeling. And it's very simple to do. But most of us are not in an environment where we're ever exposed to that, so our bodies are never positioned or trained to do these kinds of things, so therefore we think they can't exist or don't appear to be real.
Dr. Bell, we are just about out of time today. It is a fascinating topic. I hope we can go more into it.
Oh, yeah, it's the topic of my life. You know, it's my favorite thing I like to get into. Yeah, you can reach us for vitamins. We have the best vitamins in the world and receptor information at 891 Santa Ana Street in Laguna Beach. The zip is 92651. Or you can telephone area code 714-499-2603.
Very good. Dr. Bell, you have yourself a great weekend. I look forward to talking to you on Monday.
Great, and I look forward to having our seminar on November 14th with everybody out there, too.
Yes, indeed. By the way, how do they register for that?
We'll be announcing that about 10 days before the seminar.
Okay, well, we can all look forward to that also. Dr. Fred Bell, we'll be back with you on Monday between 11 and 11:30. Have a great weekend.
You too.
Bye-bye.
You have been listening to BBS Radio, a blogandservice.com production and a Service to Others endeavor. Thank you very much for tuning in to our radio program, and we wish you much peace and joy on your journey.